Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
A martini, shaken, not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
It is time for Movies and Booze. Chris Wasser, Michelle Lawler, and straight from her job in the car wash, Fionnuala Jones are with us once in a while. Lisa Spiller says in her T-shirt. McCarthy's Car Wash and Childcare. That's a great combination.
It is a great combination, yeah. It's a t-shirt brand called Ganstro, and they do like funny, novelty, good quality t-shirts.
All right, okay. Yeah. I just was hoping it was a real place.
It could be, but I don't think it is, unfortunately. Yeah. I'd like to imagine the kids washing the cars, but...
Yeah. No, because if you bring a car into a car wash with a child, the child often freaks out because it's kind of scary. Mm. So it would be a business idea to take the child out and go, there's a childcare place next door, and you go.
Oh, well, yeah. Get a car washed. That is smart, yeah.
Makes a certain amount of logic. Yeah. Right. How, like, are 28 years later films coming out now on a fortnightly basis? Yeah, that's my sense.
It's kind of strange because this time last year, we were still 5 months away from 28 years later, and now we already have a sequel. So it might seem a little odd to fans, but if you did watch the last film, you'll know that it ended with a cliffhanger.
Right.
Like it was half a story, or maybe even a third of a story, because if this film, if this latest one, 28 years later, The Bone Temple, if it performs well... You might have seen Cillian Murphy on the red carpet for 28 years later, The Bone Temple. He's an executive producer. He might also have some other involvement, which we won't get into. If this film performs well, there's a final chapter in development. There's a script all ready to go. Danny Boyle is ready to direct it, and he will be the leading man. So there's one more picture left after this. So we are getting regular 28 years
and
later
pictures. And will that be it, or are we looking at a Marvel Universe type scenario?
I think this feels like a Marvel Cinematic Universe sort of thing where, you know, it feels like a side story to the main story in a way. So if these things keep performing and if people like them and if people pay to watch them, I think we could be getting these for another 28 years later, which is a shame because that's kind of what made the first one and to an extent even the second one, which Danny Boyle wasn't involved in, so special that, you know, there was so little of this tale, and it was up to us to imagine what happened next to Jim. So I do kind of miss that. So today, yeah, we're going to be looking at 28 years later, The Bone Temple, and we're also going to be looking at Rental Family with Brendan Fraser. So Brendan Fraser's back in the room. He's got some more like...
And this is more like comedy type stuff, is
it? It's light comedy, sentimental drama. Brendan Fraser playing an American actor who's living in Japan, who gets a job working for a service where he pretends to be a friend or a family member to complete strangers. These are real services. They really do exist.
Well, I imagine at one point in his career he was possibly tempted to do it.
I'd say at one point, it might have been one of the only options for him. Yeah, so we've got Brendan Fraser piling on the tearjerker stuff and a lot of undead fun with Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah, and we're going to be talking about Sancerre. Is that how you pronounce it?
We're going to be talking about Sancerre, but that's not the interesting thing we're going to be talking about. I have two Sancerre. One is sealed with a cork and one is sealed with a screw cap.
Okay.
And probably one of the most frequent questions and comments I get is, which is better? I hate one of them, whichever, normally a screw cap. And what do I do in a restaurant? And actually, the reason why... Shut up and eat your dinner. The reason why is because before Christmas, one of the wines that we have sold for years and years, a Sancerre, that has always been in a screw cap, arrived in a cork. And I was like, oh, that's quirky. And then I mentally banked that and did nothing with it. And then when we opened up the business again on the 5th of January, I was like, God, that'd be a great thing to do on News Talk. I'm sure they were all sold. So I have two different Sancerres, not the same one to compare. however, it is actually really cool because I would say, without realising it, it's one of the most thought about aspects of wine. Like, you go to buy one and it's in your head as a decision. Which is better? Which is worse? You go into a pub, there's a quarter bottle and it's in a screw cap and you're like, ugh, or an aeroplane or whatever. So actually, I just thought, we will talk about...
Yeah, I don't know. often it's... Which is less hassle to open? And screw cap always wins that
way,
obviously.
So one of the things, actually, when you work in a restaurant, if you're in a fast-moving restaurant, some wine buyers will only buy wines by the glass that are sealed with a screw cap because it's just speed.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many things that go into
it. Begs the question, then. You're in a relatively fancy restaurant and, you know, whether it's a screw cap or a cork... they still go, would you like to taste it? Now, I always assume that was to see, was it corked, which it couldn't be if it's a screw cap.
Well, that is exactly it. And on Wednesday night, I never go out anywhere ever, but on Wednesday night, I went out once.
Oh, cool. Where'd you go?
Cooks in Carra. I had a business course and my friend lives in Carra. And so we went there afterwards and I loved it. We ordered a bottle of All Right Sauvignon Blanc. However, the waitress comes over and she just unscrewed it, plunked it in the bucket and said, I'll leave it to it, ladies. And I was like, wow, she should be like actually teaching people how to deal with screw cap. Because in actual fact, when you're in a restaurant, historically, they're asking you, is it corked or not? A lot of people think they're asking, do you like it? And I get asked this all the time. Am I allowed to say, no, I don't like it? And I'm like, well, not actually really. Like in theory, the sommelier or whoever should have given you a good pointer in the right direction that you found something you like. Now, if you hate it, it's a problem. But really, they're asking you if it's corked. But there just became this weird moment because really corkscrew or screw caps are only mainstream in the last 20 years. And so it's a bit of like, oh, what do we do with that?
Yeah.
We'll just ask them, would you like to try it?
But even it, like, I was in a restaurant last weekend and it was a screw top.
Yeah.
And, you know, your man went through the whole palaver. But like, you get this sense that if you say it's a screw cap, you don't have to do that. They're mildly offended, you know, that you have to go
through this.
Smell
it and say it's grand. There is actually one taint or issue that you can have with the screw cap because there's literally no air that gets in. Mm. It's called to be reductive. And it's what happens is it can create like a struck match smell. But once the wine is open for like 5-10 minutes, it blows off. But ultimately, you could just say it's grand, which is what I do.
Yeah. It's grand. Tell the sommelier. Right. So are we nearly having a complete cast for White Lotus season 4?
We're getting pretty close, I would say, because there are reports this week that Chris Messina is in early talks to join this cast. Chris Messina, who people might remember from 6 Feet Under, The Mindy Project, Sharp Objects, my favourite. Not confirmed, but if he does confirm, he'd be joining Alexander Ludwig, who is from kind of like very much working actor vibes. I remember him from The Hunger Games, but he's been in loads of other things. And AJ Michalka, who is kind of a Disney star, and she has a musical project with her sister Ali, who's also a Disney star. They've kind of been doing that. She hasn't done much acting. I think she did a Big Bang Theory spin-off, but this is kind of the most prestige-y thing she's done since. They've been announced, and also there were loads of reports initially that Helena Bonham Carter was in negotiations.
Oh.
There's kind of been no confirmation about that since, but I would kind of nearly take that as confirmation, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. Season 4, they're heading to France, as we spoke about previously, and we've confirmed that they're filming predominantly in Saint-Tropez in a palace-turned hotel. So 19th
fancy.
Century, very,
super
very fancy. Very, very fancy.
Would any of these people like have to do auditions? Or is it just that, you know, they're in talks?
No, I don't think so. Well, Helena Bonham Carter's not auditioning. No. You know what I mean?
Can you imagine Helena Bonham Carter auditioning?
I don't know. If she really wanted to do it.
Yeah. You know what you're getting with Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah.
No, that's true. Yeah, we have this crazy woman who lives in the top room by herself, screaming out the window.
Maybe poor Alexander and AJ. Maybe some of the...
Yeah.
When I say lesser, I mean lesser known, not lesser as caliber of actor, but maybe there. But like, I don't know. But like, White Lotus is good at kind of... You know, what's the phrase? Sea raises all boats. That's terrible.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like getting the kind of the mix of the really big names and the kind of catchy names and people you've never heard of or people who've been doing loads of things but don't really have the name recognition. So,
yeah,
be interesting.
So, if Chris doesn't get the role in White Lotus, Chris can also just plant a rumor that he's going to be the next James Bond, and then you're off at the races. Then
I would kind of love to see Chris Messina as the next James Bond, but that looks very unlikely. I would say, look, there's like every time I'm in here, there's a new Bond story, I think, and it continues to rumble on as Amazon gets its greedy little paws all over it. But there was just this piece in the Hollywood Reporter this week talking about how basically like publicists are gaming the system of the Bond conversation to be like to get their clients out there and won't kind of get that name recognition again without actually having to be shackled to Bond. You know what I mean? So last week everyone was like, it's Callum Turner, who was just in Eternity and like he's Mr. Dua Lipa, and a lot of weird reports being like, yeah, they're definitely going to do it and it's going to be a 2-for-1 deal. Dua Lipa's going to do the song. It's going to be great. Now again, I will also say I would like to see Callum Turner as James Bond because
okay.
The way he looks. But and also I saw Eternity, he's good in Eternity, whatever. But yeah, basically there's report that like basically they're just like, yeah, we'll just get the names out there and see, even though there might be absolutely no basis to it. Because in this piece as well, they were talking about how when Timothy Dalton was not going to be Bond anymore, that there was rumours that Mel Gibson was going to step in for him.
Wow,
which I did not know, and is such a horrifying thought. That's
interesting one.
That's a bad place. Okay.
Anti-Semitic Bond.
Yeah.
But there's nowhere even close to actually choosing anyone, as far as anyone can tell.
I'd say they know who it is. I'd say they, or if they don't,
do you reckon?
Yeah, and I'd say they know the age bracket. So Stephen Knight is writing the film, Denis Villeneuve is hired to direct. There's no way you put that sort of team together without having some sort of idea of either like the age bracket of the actor or who. I'd say it's sealed. It's done. They're just sitting on it.
They talked about pre-Amazon that it was going to be someone younger, and that's when the Tom Holland stuff happened. And like, if it is Callum Turner, then Callum Turner does kind of fit that bill. But then I don't know if that's changed, as you said, because this was pre them bringing in Denis Villeneuve.
Is age relevant? Unless it's somebody, it's wheelchair bound.
Well, unless you're doing latter years Bond, bruised and banjaxed and ready to,
James Bond does the same things, get in fights and goes to bed with people. That's, that's ageless activity, really.
The little snapshot into Sean's life.
Yeah, there you go. It's just you need pills later on for the film, for the fights anyway. I drank a bottle of red wine, which was opened a year, screw cap. It was grand. I didn't know you have to drink it within 3 to 5 days after breaking the seal. There you go.
I
constitution
would say it
like
wasn't
a horse.
That's grand. But my question is, had that person drunk more wine prior to then going to the dregs?
Could be. Yeah, could be. I thought, somebody else says, I thought corked meant it had been oxidized. So whether or not it's a screw top, it's really just that the oxygen has leaked in and ruined the wine. Same as wine that's left open for too long, it turns to vinegar.
I'd say that's fake news.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
okay.
So actually, oxidized is a thing. And the easiest way to describe oxidized is by talking about a banana, if you can believe that. You know when you peel a banana and it's lovely and fresh and then you leave it for like, I don't know, an hour or 2 hours and it turns brown.
Yeah.
And then when you eat it, it's much more confected. And that is because air has got to the fruit. So what happens with a wine when you leave it open for a day or two? It gets oxidized. So if you imagine the same thing, it will taste more jammy on a red wine, and on a white wine, it will taste like a bruised apple. But that is oxidized. To describe a corked wine, or what it means when something is corked, cork actually comes from a tree, a Portuguese tree. And if you ever really wanted to see one, if you go to Mount Usher, there's a tree walk, it's ladder and maybe like tree 20 or something. It's an actual cork tree. But what happens is that in some trees, as in nature, you might get a little bit of like a fungi in the tree. And when you bring something into a production plant, historically, a lot of the production plants in whatever capacity would be cleaned with chlorine. And when chlorine interacts with this particular fungi, if it's in the tree, it creates a chemical compound called TCA, and that is cork taint.
Right. Excellent explanation. Yeah. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Right. Shall we move on to the Sancerre before this turns into a science programme?
Sorry for the geekiness, but it's the fact.
I'm partial to a bit of red Sancerre, but you don't see it as much.
I love it, Sean. You've just gone up my estimations.
Thank you.
Now, the bad news for Sean is that Sancerre, red Sancerre is produced from Pinot Noir, which in my head you hated.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
I know,
yeah.
I love it.
We can all be complicated and contradictory.
And a rosé Sancerre, if you ever have that, is actually rosé produced from the Pinot Noir grape. And I love a rosé Sancerre. You nearly have to go to France to get them. They're so delicious.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Okay, well, let's proceed with our white Sancerres.
So we're going to try two Sancerres. Now, this is like comparing an apple, like a Golden Delicious, to a Pink Lady. They're not the same thing.
Yeah.
So really the exercise was to just talk a little bit about the corks and the screw caps. However, let's try wine number one, which should be on your left-hand side if you didn't move your glasses around. They look extremely similar. So Sancerre is a place, a bit like Howth Peninsula is a place.
Okay.
And the reason why I would say Howth Peninsula is that the region for Sancerre to produce all these vines is the same size as Howth Peninsula.
Wow.
Tiny.
Okay.
It's really, really small. And the rule is, if you want to name your wine...
What's the house prices in Sancerre?
Premium. I wouldn't say, premium.
As much as Howth.
I don't think actually there are many houses there because they're all fields for grapes. I would imagine.
Yeah, that's probably the land is worth more for that reason, I would imagine.
So, if you want to call your wine Sancerre, it has to be 100% Sauvignon Blanc.
Mm.
Fact. So if you're thinking, and I get this all the time, someone say, oh, I hate Sauvignon Blanc, but I love a Sancerre. Well, it's a bit like I hate Pinot Noir, but I love a red Sancerre.
Yeah.
Because they actually are the same thing. But what is great about Sancerre is that it's a bit like Rioja. 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, it created this standard of this is what this tastes like. And I wouldn't say that it's two-dimensional, but when we taste these two wines, they're extremely similar in flavour profile and in everything they deliver. And they're really consistent. Why does Malbec do so well? It's really consistent. You know, it's not like getting a bottle of Chardonnay and you're like, oh, will it taste like vanilla or will it taste like lemons? Mm. So Sancerre tastes in a very narrow flavour of profiles. They're typically unoaked. So generally, when you talk about oak, sometimes people say, oh, I don't know, how do I avoid oak? I get this question, which is a normal question. And when you read a tasting note, if the tasting note on whatever, an app or a shop or a magazine, if the tasting note starts to say words that aren't fruits that grow on trees, for example, butter doesn't grow on a tree, or toast doesn't grow on a tree, or oak kind of does grow on a tree. But you get very much. But once it goes away from like the fruit, lemons and bananas and pineapples and grapefruits and all these things, once you start finding those non-fruit words, they're telling you it's actually an oak. And the thing about Sancerre and why it's so popular is that it's not an oak. It's medium bodied, it's Sauvignon Blanc, and it tastes in quite a narrow flavour profile.
That's a good tip as well about the all the things that don't grow on trees.
So this one that we have, the first one, Domaine Sauterau, is sealed with a cork. And historically, the other one have always championed being modern and contemporary and modern winemaking techniques. So they've been using screw cap for a long time. Whereas these guys are sealing one in with a cork closure. And after we taste the two, it'll be interesting to see which one you prefer. Because the reason why you would choose a cork over a screw cap, there are a couple of reasons. But the ultimate reason for choosing cork over screw cap is actually aging potential. Because when it's sealed with a screw cap, nothing gets in. So when the winemaker is in the winery and they taste the wine out of a tank and they're like, that is perfect. That's what I'm bottling. That's what I'm selling. That's what the people will love. That's what you're getting with the screw cap. Hmm. And my tip oftentimes is go for a screw cap if it's young and fruity. With a cork, it's built to age. It's built to let air in. And the goal is the evolution of the wine. So when you put something like typically like a Chardonnay or something like that would be sealed with a cork in terms of whites, if they're premium, you wouldn't really choose a screw cap because they won't develop. So when you're looking for a cork, what it's going to do is change the flavours, and you'll find, and when you taste the two of them, it actually is evident in this. The first one, which is the cork one, is less, not that it's less fruity, but I would say it's a little bit more muted. Mm. And so if you think of like a Rioja or Bordeaux, they're always in cork because the whole goal of that wine is to age, mature, change and evolve.
Yeah, are both those wines the same age?
No, I failed a little bit here. When I say we're comparing a Pink Lady to a Golden Delicious or something, one is from last year and one is from this year.
Right,
so they aren't the same.
Well, would that matter as much with a white wine?
Yeah, it really does matter a lot. And it's funny, oftentimes, you know, when you talk about wine and you're really focused specifically on the wine in front of you, as opposed to how to make a decision to choose a wine that you might be after. And I would always say white's under a certain price point. What you are looking for is youth and a screw cap. Fact. That is it. Because what you are looking for is something fresh and fruity and juicy. If you want something like a Chardonnay to have all the flavours that most people go, which is like the oak, the toast, the vanilla, the cream, all that thing, you want it to age because you need it to evolve for it to actually be in its optimum drinking window. Mm. Whereas a lot of times with the screw caps, their optimum drinking window is now. Or yesterday.
Yeah,
but that's
my optimum drinking window too, as it turns out.
Yeah,
happy coincidence.
With a red wine, when you see red wines with the screw cap, like if someone's gone into a shop, if you're looking for a white, go for youth and a screw cap. For me, if I'm looking for a red within a certain budget, like under 20, and you want to drink it now and it's like a Malbec or something, you want it in a screw cap because you want it to be like fruity and fun and juicy. If you're looking for something that's going to be a bit older, you don't want it just to taste like old fruit. You want it to have evolved and take on those extra flavours.
Ooh, somebody just sent in a good question. Plastic corks.
Ooh, great question. Yeah. So there's there's a cost, and then there's a few other elements to go into it. Plastic cork is probably the cheapest closure you can get. Then screw cap isn't the cheapest closure. And a good screw cap costs the same as a cheap good cork. So the thing with a plastic one, and it can be made from polymers, plastic or like a vegetable product-y, plasticky thing, technical term. but with that, a natural cork can breathe and it expands. It can fill the space, whereas a plastic cork, it is fixed. And so, yes, it is cheap. If your wine is made to be drunk young, perfect. You know, when I was going back to talking about your bananas being open or whatever, if the plastic cork isn't a perfect fit somehow and air gets in, it's like having, you know, your banana open for a year before you drink it. It'll get oxidized. Yeah. But there's a thing. Recently, I sold a bottle of champagne to a customer that cost €4,000. And he had big concerns over going, well, I actually buy this because how do I know it's not going to be corked? Or a million other problems that you would have with it, like not nice, too old, you know, what am I going to do with it? But in actual fact, so I spoke to one of the guys who works for the champagne house, and he had said that now what they do, it's called notarized corks. So if something is extremely premium and it has to be 100% guaranteed, each cork will actually be individually treated to make sure that that fungi, and then tested that that fungi chlorine chemical thing doesn't happen. It's the only way to describe it.
That's what you'd want for £4,000.
For £4,000, you have to. And so, for example, not everything is going to be individually done. That obviously turns it from, like, say, a 15-cent cork into a €1.50 cork, etc. And given that if you're going to spend whatever amount, I won't go into the taxes and all the other boring things. So, so a lot of times corks are batch tested. But if you're going to go for your £4,000 bottle of champagne, that is, they're individually tested and individually.
Absolutely. Yeah. Somebody else says, please highlight the problem of buying a glass or bottle of white wine in most bars or some restaurants, that they keep the white wine in the fridge so that the flavour is destroyed by the temperature. It's a first world huge problem caused by a lack of knowledge and staff training.
The open bottle of white or red, did that person say?
Well, they're saying white wine. I think it's mostly to do with keeping the white wine in the fridge. So what you get is absolutely freezing.
Yeah, like really, you want to be drinking wine at 8 degrees, and if the fridge is 4 degrees, it's a bit cold. You can just put it in your hands and warm it up. Yeah. I was going to say one quick more thing, and you might let me speak again. But because another thing is, how do I know if it's corked? Which is a really big question. And the like, when you open a bottle of wine, it should smell fresh and fruity and fun, and like you want to drink it. If you open it and it smells like your granny's wardrobe, or like wet cardboard, that doesn't smell like something you'd want to consume.
Yeah.
So that's kind of it.
Yeah. Right. We do have to take a break. What movie would you like to do first?
We'll do the zombies first.
Okay. 28 years, whatever you call it, coming up next.
Trying to predict the future is a discouraging, hazardous occupation. In fact, it may not even exist at all.
Oh, what is this that I cannot see? Oh, I am death, none can exhale.
Many of the things we take for granted will one day pass away completely.
There you go. That's 28 years later, the Bone Temple.
Yes.
So is there an actual Bone Temple?
There is a Bone Temple, yeah.
Okay, you'd hope so.
Ray Fiennes built a Bone Temple, or at least his character is supposed to build the Bone Temple. We saw Ray in the previous 28 years later. We also saw Alfie Williams as Spike. These two films, last year's one and this one, they were shot back to back in 2024. Both written by Alex Garland, who wrote the original. One directed by Danny Boyle, that was the one we got last year. This one directed by Nia DaCosta, who made the Candyman remake and also recently Hedda with Tessa Thompson. And so this film picks up immediately where the last one ended. Now, if you recall the last one, I actually wasn't much of a fan of the last one. I thought the original 28 Days Later was just a true original, like, and a true game changer as well. It was completely unlike anything else in the, you know, zombie apocalyptic fiction box. It was just the ideas that you can spot its influence on 101 different horror stories still. You know, there are still films and TV shows being made that are so, you know, have an awful lot to thank that film for. In contrast, I thought the sequel, although you were getting Danny Boyle and Alex Garland, you were getting the band back together, Cillian Murphy producing with A Night to Star somewhere down the line, I just found it quite choppy, quite inconsistent, not really sure you know, I don't think really knew what it was doing. Too many ideas, even. And it also came with an ending that was so catastrophically stupid that I had to check with my colleagues to make sure that I hadn't dreamt the whole thing up.
Yeah.
Because it ends in the woods where Alfie, who's the preteen protagonist of this new trilogy, his mom, Jodie Comer, has just died. She's buried in the Bone Temple. Sorry if I've spoiled it. That's the last film. His dad, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, is quarantined back on, you know, the other side of the county. Alfie's all alone in the woods. And forget about the flesh-eating ghouls. He comes across this human gang, the leader of which is Jack O'Connell, who all style themselves after Jimmy Savile. And they call themselves the Jimmies.
Yeah.
So these guys are a bit of a cult. Jack O'Connell is their demented leader who believes himself to be the devil's representative on Earth. He's gathered up the vulnerable and the helpless. He's an original survivor, or he's a survivor of the original Rage virus outbreak. And you, as I say, don't worry about the zombies. You have to worry about these guys.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure to this day what Alex Garden and Danny Boyle are trying to say there. Something about some misplaced sense of nostalgia. Something about the idea that when the Rage virus would have taken off, all you had was basically rumors about Jimmy Savile's despicable behavior. It wasn't actually confirmed in the news just yet. I don't really know. Or again, they might be trying to say something about, you know, the true horrors of this world.
But to an audience just outside Britain and Ireland, they wouldn't know who Jimmy makes no sense at all.
No, you're going to have people go, why are they in yellow wigs? What's the story with the tracksuits and the jewelry? And why are they? Why do they keep saying, how's that? What does that actually mean? So we have this story. So that's not a great starting point for me at all.
Yeah.
I thought it was in such poor taste and not very effective at all. So anyway, we start with that. Alfie reluctantly teams up with them because he has no choice. They'll either kill him if he either signs up to, you know, be a Jimmy, he has to wear a wig and a tracksuit, or they'll kill him. And they set about, you know, just basically making whatever survivors they come across their lives an even worse hell. They stumble upon a farmhouse, they find people there, and they essentially torture them in some of the nastiest, almost torture horror porn stuff that I've seen in an awful long time. Mm. The other side of the story I really liked. So you've got this crazy doctor, the Colonel Kurtz of the film, played by Ralph Fiennes, hanging out on the other side of the woods, surrounded by his bone temple. The bones are basically the people who he knew who have died, or zombies that he's actually, you know, burnt the flesh off of and built this bone temple. He spent a bit too long by himself, Sean, basically.
Okay, you can see that.
He's discovered an alpha zombie male named Sanson, played by Chill Lewis Parry. He's an enormous beast of a man, and he's discovered a way to stop Sanson from basically tearing people's heads off their shoulders, and it involves shooting them with morphine arrows. And you have this case where Sanson actually becomes addicted to the morphine, and the two of them form this unusual connection. Now, I won't tell you where that connection goes, but let's just say that so much morphine changes the zombies' behavior a little bit, and that there might be some sort of hope on the horizon. If I would watch an hour and a half of Ralph Fiennes hanging out with a zombie and the two of them getting high on morphine and dancing to Duran Duran.
Cool.
It's fantastic. All that stuff. If you thought you, like Ralph Fiennes has starred in a lot of different films and shows where he's got to show us what he can do when, you know, someone presses play on a great song. We've seen him dance before. Not like this. The performance here by Ralph Fiennes is wonderful. Unfortunately, I just found there was an awful lot of pushing and shoving to get the Jimmies in the same path as Ralph Fiennes. And when they do actually meet, it's just a whole lot of nastiness. It doesn't really make any sense. I found it just quite mean-spirited at times. I thought Jack O'Connell, like, Ralph Fiennes is going overboard, but it's fun. Mm. Jack O'Connell is going overboard, but it's just, I found it too hammy.
Yeah.
And it all heads towards like some sort of convoluted closer where, look, if you've been paying attention to the production headlines and if you've been paying attention to the red carpet the other night, you will know that a certain Mr. Murphy might be involved in more than just an executive producer capacity. It's all headed towards something that looks as if it might actually be decent. The final picture might actually be decent, but it all kind of made me think, what was the point in this? This is just some weird stopgap.
Is it worse than the film before it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, because I just found I think it's unfortunate that Nia DaCosta, who is a great filmmaker, that she was hired to produce a zombie film direct a zombie film that has very few zombies in it.
Yeah.
And I think to prioritise that Jimmy nonsense is just a massive mistake for this franchise. This works as like a little short, maybe, that they could have put out, a short story for television, something for streaming, whatever, not as a major 28 Days Later sequel. It just doesn't work for me. I think maybe I preferred the last one because you had Jodie Comer, you had Aaron Taylor-Johnson. Mm. Their stories were quite interesting. This Jimmy nonsense, I'm not buying it.
Right. It's hard to think of a segue from that to the follow-up to Derry Girls. So I won't even try to do that.
Yeah.
It seems like, and now this is Lisa McGee's new show, but like it seems like a lot of the band are back together for
a lot
this.
Of band are back together, yeah. It's obviously Lisa McGee and her usual creative team that she'd worked on Derry Girls with. This is How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. It's out February 12th on Netflix. It's an 8-part series. I was kind of getting Bad Sisters vibes off it. I feel like that's kind of maybe a bit reductive description, but it's basically three friends, they've fallen out with another friend and the other friend is kind of estranged and they're all going about their lives, whatever. Lo and behold, they get a call, this friend is dead, they go to the funeral, everything's not as it seems. It's very spooky, creepy, whatever. And as you said, a lot of the old gang back together. Saoirse Monica Jackson has a role in this. We've also got Roisin Gallagher, Sinead Keenan, Quillian Dunn, who is, it's been fun. I'm still in my love-hate rewatch, so like seeing her pop up in things has been, because I also just started Industry as well, and she's in Industry, and I'm like the Leonardo DiCaprio meme pointing at her. And Ardal O'Hanlon's in the trailer as well. Looks good, looks promising, I would say.
Let's hope so.
Out. Go watch
I think
good.
There'll probably be a lot of good will for that in advance. Yes. Right, Michelle, let's move on to our second sans-serre.
Our second sans-serre. Now, you asked me how to pronounce it earlier. I'd say sans-serre.
Yeah.
There's always someone who knows better.
Oh, of course, yeah.
God bless them. Okay, so the next one we're going to have is Domaine Roger Champault, and this is sealed with a screw cap. So if you have a taste of it, what you find is that it's really fresh and zingy.
It's much zingier than,
Zingier. Now, there's a couple of things. It's a little bit stylistic. It is a bit younger. But I actually prefer the one sealed with a cork. I like that it's a bit softer, a bit fleshier, a bit easier. But it depends. Like, there's different, you know, one might be better with a bag of crisps, one might be better with a roast chicken.
Yeah, you could say the second one's just trying a bit too hard.
Yeah, definitely feel like it's leaning into that New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc style.
Yeah.
For sure. So listen, the screw cap wines, one of the reasons why I wanted to do two sans-serre in this screw cap versus cork is because a lot of times people think it's the cheap option, the screw cap.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, it's not. And one of the, you know, for a cheap wine, it's going to hold the freshness in. Like some wines that you might be spending, like, you know, under 12 euro on, you don't want them to be more than 1 or 2 years old. They're not going to do anything in any good way. But with screw caps, what they're trying to do is, if the wine is amazing, is keep it amazing for you to taste and enjoy. It's a really important thing to think about when you're going to try your sans-serre like that. What happened is screw cap started in the 1960s in France as a way to combat cork taint. Because if you remember, Sean, back in the day, I don't know how many years younger than I am, but I'll say back in the day, that it would be, and I had worked in a wine shop in the early noughties, they reckoned 1 in every 10 bottles sealed with a cork had cork taint.
Yeah.
And it would be extremely frequent that you would come in and ultimately give someone their money back. And they did reckon that it cost the industry something like 6 or 7% in problems. So in the 60s, they developed an alternative to that, which was the screw cap. It didn't really take off until New Zealand embraced it in the 90s. And that was a bit of social proof. What's the one? Cloudy Bay.
Yeah.
Sealed under
yes, of course.
And that kind of said, well, look, and that's premium and that's expensive. And they captures that freshness. So in the 2000s, it definitely became a lot more mainstream. But still, I would say a lot of people will decide. I did a poll on Instagram to see what was the option. You know, which did you prefer? And it was kind of neck and neck. But cork, a lot of people just have that prejudice in their brain. And so the whole point to do the two sans-serres, one in cork and one in screw cap, is actually to show you that premium wines can be done sealed with a screw cap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Don't run away from them.
Absolutely. So they're looking for... Have they announced stars for Baywatch yet, or is it just randos are going to be in
it? I'm actually not sure. This was the first I'd seen of it about this TV reboot coming from Fox, and I just thought it was funny because they've announced this open casting call in Los Angeles on February 18th if anyone's free, and because they want actors and non-actors populate the series. But conveniently in the casting call they said, you know, they're looking lifeguards, beachgoers, whatever. They're not just necessarily looking for the people doing the watching of the bay, I suppose.
Okay.
But they said as well, the casting call says that they should arrive Baywatch ready, defining that as wardrobe that evokes a beach setting, but saying that they should also remain, quote, polished, professional, and avoid overly revealing styles and costumes. To which I say, the woke mob wins again. We can't
there you
even,
go. What's the
even,
point of Baywatch if everyone's covered up?
We can't even be half naked. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just what
that's
a sham.
That's the whole thing. Yeah.
Everybody's collapsing.
It's funny that, did they say you have to be able to swim as a bear requirement?
Actually, no, I don't think so. That isn't really necessary.
That doesn't really.
They're shooting in Venice Beach. I'd imagine it'll be out 2027. I think they were saying, but I just thought it was interesting. I think we forget, like, it was one of the most watched series in the world at one point
for its searing drama, not for the fact that everyone was half naked. Absolutely not. We have to keep that.
Watch it for the storylines.
Storylines, yes, indeed. Right, we'll move on to our second movie. It is Rental Family. Here's a clip.
So, what do you think we do?
You, if I have to guess, you sell people.
No.
No.
We sell emotion.
Oh, how?
We play roles in the client's lives.
Oh, thanks. But you can't just, you know, replace someone in your life.
Yes and no. But people are willing to take a leap. The actor, the surrogate. You don't have to be that person. You just have to help clients connect to what's missing.
Right. Okay. That's a Rental Family. So he's presumably he's not doing great. The character, at least, isn't Brendan Fraser's character isn't doing well at the acting.
He's not doing well. He's had better days. Fraser's playing a man named Philip Vanderpoek, who is an actor who a little too late realized that real life doesn't come with a script. And he is very good at what he does. He's very good at taking direction, memorizing lines, pretending to be someone he's not, because it helps him to forget the person he actually is. The person who flew all the way around the world to Tokyo to star in this goofy, absurd, two-paced commercial, and he forgot to go home. He actually stayed put, spent the next 7 years in Japan. So when we find him, he's a jobbing actor who really doesn't have all that many jobs, and he's all alone. He's quite lonely too, and he wakes up one morning to a call from his agent telling him to get across town in an hour to play a sad American at a funeral.
Yeah.
Doesn't ask too many questions, shows up, doesn't see cameras, doesn't find the crew. It is actually a funeral, and it is what they call a rental family gig, in which strangers hire professional actors to play their pals, their colleagues, or their loved ones, or in this case, mourners. So Philip says exactly what we're thinking. What the hell? And what about the ethics of all this? It's an ethical minefield. Who's being lied to? You know, is it right? Like, some family members know about this, but others don't. Is that right? It's not all wrong, says the owner of the company, played by Takiro Hiro. His name is Shinji, and he kind of convinces Philip that, you know, look, you don't really have an awful lot going on at the minute, but also this is your chance to, it's as good a chance as any to deliver a true, authentic performance. You're good at what you do. I'm giving you a gig here. So he gets all sorts of gigs pretending to be people he's not, a husband to somebody, a fella who just plays video games with this guy who only ever wanted a friend to play video games with. That section I thought was just devastating. But these two long-term projects that he begins, one, he pretends to be a magazine writer interviewing a renowned Japanese actor who has begun to show signs of dementia, and he also feels quite unimportant, and his daughter wants him to feel wanted and seen again. So having Brendan Fraser pose as this American writer who's going to write a piece or a book about him will give him back his sense of worth. And the other is a mother who wants her child, who's mixed race and never actually met her American father. She wants her child to go to this elite high school, but to do so, herself and a father figure will need to be at the interview for this school. So she hires Brendan Fraser to play this little girl's dad. The girl never met her dad. The co-owner of the company says to Brendan Fraser's character, don't get emotionally involved. I probably don't need to say what happens next.
Yeah.
It should not work. And I, you know, came out of this thinking that if you had any other actor in that role in this film, it would just collapse in on itself. It would just be sinister or icky or weird. It's that elusive Brendan Fraser magic where the second this gentle giant walks into the room, it's just, you want to know more about him. Instantly like him, you're instantly charmed by him. You know, when he smiles, you laugh. When he gets emotional, your heart just breaks. He's brilliant in this. And I just thought, like, he makes it work. There's no other actor that could have made it work like this. It's a better fit for him than, I think, The Whale. I thought he was quite good in The Whale, but the film was just a
terrible
farce. Just a travesty. This is much better. I think the Japanese filmmaker, the director and co-writer, is an actor turned director named Hikari. I think she's very lucky to have Brendan Fraser in the room. But also, it's a chance. As much as Philip Vanderpoel wants to give like a true authentic performance, this is a chance for Brendan Fraser to do the same. And he really does, because there's times in this film where I was sitting there thinking, where are you pulling that sadness from? because it looks real. It really does. And you start to remember as well that Brendan Fraser, for a while, he was a man who just unfortunately had a rain cloud over his head for a while, and he had a lot of unhappy days. He's back in the room. He is clearly in better form. He's been playing a blinder on the press circuit. He's made this film shine. It should be sappy. It should be implausible. It should just be, you know, downright wrong. It's not. So I'm very glad that, you know, that things have managed to, you know, turn themselves around for Brendan Fraser. And I'm very glad that I saw this film, because it would be such an easy film to give out about without watching. But when you do, you will be charmed by it. It is totally emotionally manipulative at times, but I'm going to let it slide.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad to hear that, really. I'm glad to hear that. Finally, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck have revealed that they nearly made this movie about two gay characters within male sports that's traditionally, obviously, somewhat hostile towards gay relationships, and they have to keep it quiet and continue their love affair. No one's done anything like that, really. No. I can't think of anything like that in popular culture.
How many minutes are we in that I haven't mentioned Heated Rivalry? 54. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, they're obviously on the promo trail because they're promoting The Rip, which is on Netflix now, I think. And they were talking about how at one point they had a script based on the 1992 novel The Dreyfus Affair, which was about a married shortstop, Randy Dreyfus, who falls in love with a second baseman, and he's black, and there's all these issues of homophobia and racism. He said he made it years ago, said the book was great, but the script just wasn't good enough. So now I'm wondering, are they like the Heated Rivalry?
The
and they're like,
train.
Ben, get back in the room. Get your quill out. We need to write this. Yeah. People love sports.
That was our idea. We nearly did that first. We totally did. Except it was basketball. Anyway, that's our lot for today. Thanks to Fionnuala, Michelle and Chris.
Movies and Booze on Moncrief.
Of all the gin joints in all the world, she walks into mine.
The martini, shaken not stirred.
I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.